Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 1st. 1 month down. Like a long month, but it was a short one.
Wow.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2250.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2250 was brought to us by the Department of Corrections. It modifies deadlines for when DOC must submit proposed and revised inmate release plans to the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Well, Heidi Stewart, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Heidi Stewart, Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2250. As described, the House bill reverts back the timelines in which we have to have our release plans to the parole board to 60 days rather than the 75 days. That was changed in 2013 under House Bill 3194. That has become problematic. It's difficult, as many of you know, we're working on those release plans sometimes up until the day of release, trying to find housing for individuals as they're releasing our care and custody. And so to meet that 75-day deadline has been extremely problematic. Moving it back to the original timelines would give us just the additional 15 days to be able to prepare those release plans and have some more time to put into those plans.
Okay, thank you. Are there any discussion? Yes, please. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just had a conversation with the parole board in my office last week.
Great.
About an unrelated yet somewhat related issue. And they were talking about the agreements usually take 4 months. So that's more than the time frame that you have. So is it, I guess I'm curious where the pressure comes from, because it's about a four-month period from the time an inmate knows they're going to be paroled till they're paroled. So what is the crunch with that time that you want it to be farther?
Certainly. Chair Barker, Representative Springer, this is for those going out on parole, in addition, those going out on post-prison supervision. We know we have those release dates well in advance, but preparing housing, and we send a release plan out to the field. They do a field investigation to determine if that housing is appropriate or not. Then that comes back to us. Oftentimes, the housing proposed by the individual is not approved by community corrections, so we have to go back, work with the individual again. Oftentimes, they don't have a residence to go to, so we're working with the county on some sort of transitional housing. And though knowing whether a bed's open in a transition house or not, sometimes we don't know until the day before release or a couple weeks prior to release. So we're working those plans on an ongoing basis from about 4, 5, 6 months prior to their release date.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. That helps.
Thank you.
For sure. Roughly, I know this is going to vary, how many people drop into the hopper a month that you have to start preparing for? Obviously, there's multiple months
right
here that we're talking about,
right,
but post-prison and parole, how many people are dropping into that hopper each month?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, we release a little over 400 individuals a month, so about 400 a month are dropping into that hopper.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. First, I just want to make a comment. And then ask a question of Heidi. So initially, when we were having some conversation a while back in regards to the 15 additional days that surfaced as a result of House Bill 3194, mm-hmm. You know, we're just trying to kind of, you know, beat our heads on the wall trying to figure out, well, where did that 15 days come in for the additional thing? And I've had some, you know, conversation with some folks that were involved with that, and we just don't recall. You know, I can't find any of my notes either when we were in the process of developing that. So my question to you, though, is would you, rather than making this a statute into reducing it to 60 days, would you rather be in a position to have administrative rule-making authority to deal with this?
Representative Barker, Representative Olson, I would absolutely be in favor of that. I would like to touch base with Chair Wu at the Board of Parole. I believe he's in favor of it and would support that also, but would like to confirm and get back to you, and if so, we would be very supportive and happy to make those amendments.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll just add the comment of that. One of the things we continually pass laws that sometimes would be better handled by rulemaking just because of this. Mm-hmm. A year or two later, things have changed.
That makes sense.
And then you have to come back and undo a law, which is a little more difficult than a rule.
Absolutely agree.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2250. And open. Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 2616.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2616 requires the court to inform youth and youth guardian of the right to counsel in juvenile delinquency proceedings. It prohibits youth from waiving the right to counsel except when the youth is entering into a formal accountability agreement. There is a -1 amendment. The -1 prohibits youth from waiving counsel unless the youth is entering into a formal accountability agreement or certain procedures are met. It also specifies the procedures for a youth to waive counsel. Do we want to do the phone?
Yes, if we can.
And we do have a phone call to make, so I will try that.
Do you mind if we have Mr. Curry go last?
Oh,
okay, that'd be fine.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Mary Sell, Judge Welch, and Amy Miller.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker. Vice Chair Olson has escaped us. Vice Chair Williamson and members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I am with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Currently, you are getting to know me as the co-lobbyist for OCDLA. However, over the past 5 years, I have practiced adult and juvenile law. For 4 of those years, a large part of my caseload consisted of delinquency cases. This bill means a lot to me as a practitioner, and it also means a lot to OCDLA as an organization. We are proposing this change in the law at the urging of our membership and our special juvenile law legislative committee. What I want to address first is I have uploaded written testimony, and so I'm going to try to keep my remarks short. I've also uploaded an article called What We Know Now About Adolescent Brain Development. This is going to be important because it provides a context to the proposed change in the law that we're asking you to consider. So, first and foremost, in May, we will be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court case In re Galt. This was a case about a 15-year-old boy in Arizona who was accused of making a prank call. Without knowing what he was charged with or having the advice of a lawyer, this young boy was sentenced to years, multiple years, in juvenile prison. The Supreme Court in that in re Galt established that youths are entitled to the same due process as adults, including the right to counsel. OCDLA is behind the -1 amendment, and what we want our bill to do is the following. For court-involved proceedings, we want youths 11 years old and younger not to actually be able to waive the right to counsel at all. For youths 12 years and older, the court may only accept a waiver of counsel if the child has been appointed counsel for purposes of consultation with counsel about the case and about waiver. The waiver must be in writing and in open court, and the court must engage in a colloquy to determine that the waiver is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. There is a second piece of this bill focused currently on formal accountability agreements. Formal accountability agreements are essentially diversion for kids, and that's where petitions are not filed in court and the case is not court involved. In those cases, we want the juvenile department to be able to sit down with the youth and offer that diversion. And so we recognize that this should look a little bit different in those cases. So waiver of counsel may occur for those, but only in writing after notice of the right to counsel is provided to the youth and to the parents. And so that would be where the juvenile counselor is sitting down with the youth and providing this information to them. So currently in Oregon, the current status of the law. Youths must be advised by the court on the record of the charges they are facing and advised of the risks of going without a lawyer. You're going to hear that this information is dense and explained by the judge to the youth, and the youth makes a snap decision usually then and there without having any idea of the strengths or weaknesses of their case or time to carefully consider what it means to actually represent themselves going forward. Often the youth isn't really considering representing themselves. They're considering pleading to a charge, often to get out of detention. So I do want to briefly address that there are some stakeholders that we've been having conversations with who are interested in what sound to me like some topical language type amendments, and we're absolutely open to that, and I believe that we're going to be scheduling a meeting with them next week so that we can address those edits. It sounds like there's a lot of support for the concept. So why the bill? There is a problem in Oregon. There are youths waiving the right to counsel without the procedural safeguards of a lawyer helping them to determine what it means to have an attorney and give up an attorney, much less what it means to represent themselves. I guess one point that I absolutely want to make is there are far-reaching consequences of adjudications in juvenile court. So adjudications are like convictions in adult court. Juvenile court is often thought as a softer version of the adult criminal justice system, but that really isn't the case. There are collateral consequences and long-term consequences for youths who find themselves in juvenile court. You are going to hear testimony from the Honorable Betsy Welch sitting to my right, a judge out of Multnomah County who witnessed this problem on the ground and the steps that were taken over the last few years to try to actually fix this problem without coming to the legislature. You will hear testimony from Amy Miller, who will talk about data compiled by the Office of Public Defense Services showing that youths in Oregon waive their right to counsel. In 2015, just over 100 youths in both felony and misdemeanor cases waived their right to have a lawyer talk to them about their case. This number is likely higher when you count probation violations. In the proposed Dash 1 amendment, we want to include probation violations as having the right attach at that point as well. So this may appear to be a small number, and I do want to add that this is good for the potential fiscal impact. However, it is important to note that even 100 youths waiving their right to counsel means that they are not being afforded the same due process right Oregon courts afford adults. In my practice as a lawyer in both adult and juvenile court, it's incredibly difficult for an adult to waive their right to be represented. A lot of times, judges just won't let adults waive the right to counsel. The same cannot be said for juvenile courts. And I think that it's important to note that there's value in the perception of procedural due process as well as due process on the ground actually happening. I do want to recount an experience that I've had over and over again. Four of the 5 years that I was in practice, I focused on adult criminal defense, but I also did a large amount of juvenile delinquency. Oftentimes, I would be sitting down with a teenager in either detention or at my office having a conversation with them about their face sheet, the face sheet being their criminal, essentially their juvenile criminal history. A lot of times, they would have an adjudication for a felony or misdemeanor, and there would be no listed counsel, and they would not be able to recount details of what actually happened when they were in court. They wouldn't be able to tell me what the deal was. They wouldn't be able to tell me whether the charge that was on the record was a felony or a misdemeanor. They wouldn't be able to tell me who what their probation conditions were. They would have really no idea, and these are 14, 15, 16-year-old kids. Often, what they would tell me is, well, I wanted to get out of detention. This is deeply disturbing to me now, and it was then, because what this means is at a great time of stress, these two choice points were conflated for the kids. One, you can have a lawyer, or two, you can get out of custody now by admitting to the charge and going on probation. And the reason why that's important to know is because brain science. And so what we know is that juveniles' brains are literally different informed differently and not fully formed. They think and see the world different. They process differently. You are going to hear testimony from Tim Curry. He's the Director of Training and Technical Assistance with the National Juvenile Defender Center in Washington, D.C., and he's going to explain the concepts of hot and cold cognition. And so this is when juveniles are making decisions in high-stress situations and then making decisions in calmer situations. And he's going to explain how this plays out. Kids simply do not make good decisions under pressure. We're not saying that they can't make good decisions. They can. But what our bill is addressing and what we believe is kids can make good decisions when they are given an appropriate amount of time to consider their options, to understand what the legal concepts are, to understand what the collateral consequences are, to understand what the long-term effects are going to be. And so it doesn't sound to me that there's going to be much pushback, because I do think that this concept makes a lot of sense, and I think a lot of people agree with that. But I did want to address kind of these two thoughts. If we're talking about a couple hundred kids a year, there could be a concern that maybe that would slow the courts down too much. I doubt it, but my thought is even if it does slow the courts down just a touch, that's better than compromising constitutional rights and due process at the expense of kids' futures. The other concept is, well, these kids aren't alone. There's other people in the courtroom who care about them and who have their best interests at heart. And I'm not going to disagree with that. It's true that there are parents and juvenile counselors, and yes, I'm going to admit prosecutors who care. But a lawyer, I gotta laugh. That was what I was going for. But a lawyer is for the accused only. And so In re Galt is a great decision for many reasons, but it actually specifically says that only lawyers are the dedicated advocates for youths. Everyone else has their own interests and goals. And so there's a lot more that I would love to share, but I'm gonna go ahead and end now. OCDLA is simply asking for your support in a yes vote on House Bill 2616. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Judge?
Good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Welch, and I am a retired Multnomah County Circuit Court judge. But I want to tell you just a real wee bit about the other labels I have so you can see what perspective I bring. I was a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County for many years in private practice. I was the chief judge of the family and juvenile court in Multnomah County. After I retired, I was a Plan B judge and was all over the place, which was really what got this effort, and saw what was going on in other parts of the state. And I'm sure this is true in other areas besides juvenile justice, but the difference between what goes on in counties around this state is mind-boggling. I mean, just totally different philosophies, attitudes, practices, and so forth. And I am also a commissioner on the Public Defense Services Commission. I am here to share with you my views on the impropriety of allowing children in the juvenile court to waive their rights. I want to talk a little bit about what In re Galt said, a little more specificity, and I think it's important because you may not know much of the history of a juvenile court, what things were like before Galt. There were probably no prosecutors. There were no defense lawyers. There was the judge, and the judge is pictured in one's mind as having beautiful silver gray hair and a big black robe on, and they are the dispensers of justice. There were no rules of evidence, okay? I don't know how many lawyers there are here, but there were no rules of evidence. It was just come in and tell me what you think and what you thought you heard and what you saw and what somebody else told you, and then the judge decides whether this kid needs to get a consequence. And Galt's a good example because this kid got, whether he did this offense or not, it was a very minor offense, and he got multiple years in a correctional facility. I mean, that's the judge as parent, parents patriae, I'm sure you've heard that phrase somewhere along the line, that's what it looked like. And it was very well intentioned. It was the whole idea when the juvenile court system was founded. It's been about 120 years ago in Chicago. The whole idea was to pull kids out of the criminal system. They were jailed with adults. They were processed with and like adults. And there were, you know, there wasn't a lot of due process then for anybody. And the idea was, well, we're going to take away any kind of procedure, but what we're going to substitute for it is this parental devotion to your what's right. And what the Supreme Court said is the deal's off. You haven't lived up to that level of functioning. We're going to go back to basics. These are citizens of the United States. They're people. They're important, and they need to have some procedural protections. So Galt says procedural protections. And the reaction in juvenile departments in Maui, see, I'm at a school already at this point, so I'm involved, aware of this. The resistance is terrific. What do you mean? I mean, just like any other organization that has to change, we were doing good and avoiding evil. Why do we have to change? We don't want to. And you know what? They didn't. And what we're talking about today should have happened within a few years of the decision in Galt, but it hasn't, because lawyers are a nuisance. That's the philosophy. They get in the way, they slow things down. And my reaction to that is, that's true. They do get in the way, and that's exactly what they're there for. They are there to protect their client. So I retire, and I go on Plan B, which is a great system, by the way, in my opinion, and I travel around the state hearing juvenile cases because nobody else wants to, and I do. And as I say, the practice is so varied. And I will not name the jurisdiction where this happened, but the first day I was there, and I spent quite a few weeks in this particular court over a couple of years, there's a first appearance for a little Hispanic kid. First hearing, first Monday morning. So this little kid comes into the courtroom, big bench and all that usual stuff, and the juvenile court counselor says, this is Juan Rodriguez's English second language kid. And he was arrested last night for burglary in a residence. And I've met with him and I've filed a petition charging him with burglary in the first degree because it is, after all, a residence. And I've talked to him and I've told him that what I'm going to recommend that the court do is in terms of a punishment. And so Juan has decided, by the way, that's not his name, that he wants to enter a plea today. Now, again, I don't know how many of you are lawyers. I know some are. An adult wouldn't be allowed to do that. And so I was kind of like, I went like this, you're kidding, you know. And so I made, the poor guy had to, he didn't know what to do, so he just repeated his spiel again. And I said, no, it's not going to happen. He needs a lawyer. That juvenile court counselor took me aside a few days later and said, now you know, Your Honor, we want our kids to face the consequences of their behavior and learn from their mistakes, implying that what I was doing was somehow interfering with that. And so I was already on the Public Defense Services Commission, and I went and told on this court, and we started looking at this. And there was some research done with the help of a student then at the University of Oregon Law School that approximately 65% of the kids in Oregon charged with offenses were waiving their rights. Now, first of all, to waive a right, you have to know what it is, to understand what they're talking about, and to knowingly give up the right. Now, I suspect there are a few parents and grandparents and school teachers and so whatever here. Do you know a teenager that could do any of those things? A young teenager? Mm-hmm. To understand what the right to confront the witnesses against you, the right to remain silent. Of course not. Now, I'm not saying there's no, everybody has their genius grandchild or son, but the generality is clearly true that kids can't do that. No disrespect to the brain scientists. I think common sense is kind of the issue here. So we started at the commission to try to do something. We met with juvenile court directors, very chilly reception. We met with some judges. We had some help from the Supreme Court. And the reaction was deafening silence. No, we will not change it. We're doing it right. And here the judges are saying, we know how to talk to the kids, so they'll understand all this. But to do that thoroughly, if you think about a kid you know, to go through each step of a waiver process, and I won't take you through it, I promise, and explain it and all of its implications, and collateral consequences is something that a lot of people don't understand that are adults. But, you know, what does it mean to have a record as a juvenile? What effect does it have on your getting in school, getting in employment, getting in the military, you name it? I mean, it's all, there's all sorts of stuff there, and I'm not an expert on the subject either. But, and of course, my favorite is, what's a lawyer's job? So I used to ask kids when they were pleading guilty, because that's another one of these rituals, they had lawyers. What do these things mean? What is your lawyer? What is a lawyer's job? The answers were, you know, you could almost write them. The answer things like, well, I don't need a lawyer unless I'm guilty. No, I don't need a lawyer unless I'm innocent. Excuse me. In other words, the lawyer's function is to get you off when you're innocent. And what youngster knows what plea bargaining is? And to me, that's the best example I can give you. District attorney charges. Remember, I was the deputy district attorney. I'm not of the prosecutors or whatever. I lost my train of thought. You charge, and it's very common, I see it all the time, you charge everything you can off of a police report. You don't necessarily expect that the kid's going to be found guilty of all those things, or the adult, whatever. But the whole point of bargaining, what you do as a lawyer with the prosecutor, is to maybe get some of the charges dismissed, or maybe that burglary, this poor little kid who was 12 years old, I couldn't see him, he was so tiny, never been in juvenile court before, never been arrested before. I don't think his parents were there, but they might have been. But they probably didn't speak very good English. I mean, the whole situation was like something out of a nightmare. It was just ridiculous. What children in our system are thinking about, whether they're in detention or not, is how do I get this over with? And this goes back to the consequences. What 12, 13-year-old thinks about what will happen down the road? A week from making a bad choice, much less for the rest of their lives. In the issue of waiving the right to counsel, parental pressure is a very big issue. And doesn't usually get that much attention in these kind of discussions, so I would like to tell you a little bit about how that works. Your kid gets stopped for stealing a car. That doesn't happen too much anymore because cars have gotten so sophisticated, but we used to have lots of car thefts. And the parent, functional, perfectly reasonable, working class parent, is mad at their kid. So you come to court and they say, Madam, you have to fill out this form about your finances because we're going to look at appointing your counsel. I don't want to. I don't want him to have a lawyer. I want this to be over with. I want him to be punished. I want him to be held responsible. Now, without impugning her motivation, from the standpoint of how the state relates to a child, what she thinks is not very important. The issue is, does he or she understand what they're doing, the choice that they're making, have the alternatives of a formal accountability agreement been discussed, the possibility on it? You know, it goes on and on and on. We have separate courts for children. And sometimes I think we've lost track of why we're doing this. Mm-hmm. Children are not yet fully formed. They are, the brain science people can talk better than I, than any lawyer can about that. If we still believe that this court has a function, children need to have help along the way and protection from their bad choices. Be happy to answer any questions
that you might have.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, and Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Amy Miller. I'm the Deputy General Counsel at the Office of Public Defense Services. And like the other two women at this table, this bill is near and dear to my heart. I left a career in engineering to go back to law school to work with children and youth families. And This bill is near and dear to my heart. I left my career in engineering to go back to law school to work with children and youth, and worked as a public defender at Youth Rights and Justice and Multnomah Defenders in Multnomah County before coming to this job where I represented children and parents. So you heard a little bit about the landmark decision, Galt, and what it did for children that were caught up in the juvenile justice system. But here we are 50 years later today, still talking about these protections, still talking about implementing these protections. And this is not unique to us here in Oregon. This has been happening around the country. But I think what has happened in the last 10 years is that the Supreme Court has recognized through a long line of cases, right, starting with Roper, finding the death penalty unconstitutional for juveniles, has decided that adolescents are different, right? And you've all, I'm sure by now, through personal experience and through testimony, have heard about the brain research that really crystallizes that point. But the Supreme Court, you know, has done the same. The consequence is now that youth are no longer simply young adults, right? They're youth. But here in Oregon, with this particular issue, our courts have continued to treat youth like adults, like young adults, and that's been the problem. There isn't any law here that protects a youth from waiving counsel, nothing that's different than what would happen in the adult system. So Oregon law does require the court discuss the decision about waiver with each youth, either on the record or in writing. And the youth, as Judge Welch said, must make a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent waiver, which is very, very difficult. My perception for a youth to do. You heard Judge Welch talk a little bit about how around the state this practice varies, and I submitted in a chart for you, and this is just a chart of unrepresented youth based on petitions filed in 2015, and you can see the numbers, right, vary across the state, and that's one of the reasons we're here today. You heard Judge Welch talk about how the commission has been working on this issue dating back to 2010, and yet it persists, and that's part of the reason we're here talking about it today. So the issue of waiver has been really a focus and a concern for the Public Defense Services Commission for the last decade. You heard a little bit about initially Judge Welch coming to the commission and some child honor students from the University of Oregon Law School doing a statewide survey about waiver of counsel. And what the students reported at that time was that between 32% and 39% of youth appeared in court unrepresented, and the waiver rate that Judge Welch was talking about ranged from 12% in felony cases to nearly 100% in formal accountability agreements and diversion types of cases. Also at that same time, and Judge Welch didn't mention this, the commission heard testimony from George Yannakis, who is a stalwart in Washington State, a longtime advocate for the rights of children and youth, and a special counsel at Team Child. And he talked about the actions Washington State had taken to address this issue. And so I think it was in 2008 or 2009, they through juvenile court rule, through court rule, they handle their they're processed differently than we do, but through court rule, they implemented something very similar to what you see here in this Dash 1 amendment. And what they found is, as a result of that, protections around the waiver of counsel, basically the waiver rate dropped. But in addition, they tracked in two different counties what happened just to the number of filings, and they found that filings dropped by 20% in the two counties they tracked in the year following. And they attribute that to transparency that's brought to the system. So there is, of course, a cost associated with appointing counsel for these 103 youth. But I think it's worth noting that at least in Washington State, there was an observation that there were fewer filings. So since the hard work of the Public Defense Services Commission and then Chief Justice Domínguez, among others, the issue of waiver has, the number of youth waiving counsel has gradually declined, I think a large part also due to the Supreme Court line of cases, but still it persists. So in 2015, 3% of youth, 103, were unrepresented in either felony or misdemeanor cases. This rate of waiver, it's harder to wrap my head around because of the way the court system tracks data, but it's higher in probation violation proceedings, and that's noteworthy because it's these PV sanctions that stack up. And so when a youth is put on probation, one of the requirements, for example, is that they attend school. Makes total sense, right? Non-attendance of school is a violation. Repeated non-attendance of school results in increasing severe sanctions, you know, which can result in up to eight days of custody, but can eventually result in commitment to the Oregon Youth Authority or placement in the youth correctional facility. And so I think it's important that along the way, not just at this initial filing, but at these PV hearings, that these youth understand what is happening. If there's a legal basis to challenge the filing of the violation, that should occur. At a minimum, certainly the youth needs to understand the ramifications of this process that they are embarking upon. And even when a youth is on probation, it can continue for up to 5 years or up until age 23. So it's important. I do want to point out that Oregon is one of 13 states that don't provide any additional protections for youth around this issue. Other states have taken action in the form of legislation or rule, and the strategies that other states have implemented range from complete prohibition of waiver, right? Every youth gets a lawyer every time, no waiver, to not being able to waive with certain ages or certain severities of crimes, to having to have your parents' permission before you can waive counsel. So, there's a variety of different approaches out there, but we're in the minority that we haven't taken any action on this issue. I also want to point out that this is a best practice nationwide, and you'll hear from Tim Curry at the National Juvenile Defender Center, but also besides the NJDC National Standards, the American Bar Association Institute of Judicial Administration has national standards that say that counsel should be appointed at every stage of the proceedings, and in fact suggest that counsel should never be waived. Something that's in the radar of the United States government. That in 2015, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a statement of interest in NP versus Georgia, which is a class action case in Cordell County, Georgia, which is near where I'm from, where youth were really constructively being denied the right to counsel. And I think I submitted that in with your materials as well. And you can see their logic and reasoning. But in that case, settled with a number of reforms. But according to the department, what it says there is a state further deprives children of the right to counsel if its courts allow them to waive that right without first consulting with competent counsel. So, in closing, the Constitution guarantees every youth accused of delinquency whose liberty interest is at stake the right to counsel. And this right is really fundamental to the fairness of the juvenile justice system. Case law, scientific research, and practical experience reinforce the conclusion that children must have safeguards that acknowledge their vulnerability, that kids are different. The procedural safeguard of ensuring consultation with counsel prior to waiver is a concrete recognition that youth are different than adults and must be afforded special consideration. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think Mary or Amy, my questions, I got a series of questions. Mr. Chair, I understand both of you mentioned that there was 103 Oregon youth that waived their right to counsel in 2015. Are you able to tell me what the percentage of that is of those who were questioned as, I guess, an accused individual or a suspect, and then eventually went in front of the court?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, how we arrived at that number is we took a list of every single case that was charged, and we looked up individually every case where counsel wasn't appointed. I don't know that we could answer
I'm really struggling hearing you.
That's okay. I'm not feeling too. Infection, so it may be that I'm not coming across that clearly. Can you hear me now? Is that better? Okay. How we came to that number was that we took a list of every juvenile petition that was filed around the state, and on the petitions where the system did not indicate counsel was appointed, we looked them all up individually and counted them, and that's how we came to 103. To answer your question, no, that information wasn't available to us. It's just not, we were trying to deal with what's consistently entered in the court system.
So if we're follow up. Thank you. If we're going to land at that number, 103, and I realize that's kind of a ballpark number, you have any idea at all what that might cost for you being in your position?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, I do. The vast majority of those cases are misdemeanor cases. The misdemeanor case rate is between $300 and $400 for appointment on those cases. There's a handful that are felony cases. The case rate on those is between $800 and $900. And on top of the case rate, in some cases, there are expenses, so we have a slight overlay there. But certainly, I can do the math to figure it out.
Okay, and just one other further question. I would think, from my own past experience, I'm thinking I always advised, even, regardless of how young they were, their Miranda warnings, that if they wanted, and I get the idea behind the mental maturity, too. This is something I've been dealing with for a long time, on trying to go somewhere else with some, different policies. I guess my question with that, though, is this, and it's really simple. Is do you find clearly that when you have a youth offender being questioned, that they are consistently informed of their Miranda warnings? I realize.
I'll try to answer that one. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, I think that's probably difficult to put a number on that. All that I have is anecdotal evidence of my own practice. I haven't practiced nearly as long as some people in this room, but the 4 years that I did juvenile practice with delinquency clients, I would say a fair amount of kids didn't remember being Mirandized. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that they weren't Mirandized. Mm-hmm. I think that might mean that they didn't understand it. And so I know that doesn't answer your question.
That's fine. I appreciate that, Mary. So, Mr. Chair, I'm just kind of thinking, listening to some of this, I have some concerns with this bill that I'm okay. I get the bill itself. My concern would lie in the fiscal part of it. Mm-hmm. I see that we don't have it moving down to Ways and Means as a referral, so I'd have a little bit of concern with that.
Thank you. Representative Bile.
Chair Barker, and I'm not going to direct this to any one of the three of you, but I was fortunate enough to be inside the fence at McLaren last week for a while, and I probably talked to a dozen young men out there. Sadly, my recollection is that all of them were there for sex crimes that had been committed pretty early on, 14, 15 years of age. Would this do anything to change those numbers or the sentencing that maybe those individuals were subjected to?
I can answer that. Chair Barker, members of the committee, would this bill do anything to change that? I think there's a potential to say yes, and here's why. Because I mentioned when I talked in my comments about probation violations, right? And on cases where youth, some of the cases you're talking about, upon disposition, the youth were directly committed to the Oregon Youth Authority.
Right.
There are other cases where they were not. They were monitored in the community, and through violations along the way, they eventually ended up, right, in the care of the Oregon Youth Authority at a youth correctional facility. And so for those youth, having a lawyer along the way who they can consistently consult with, who they can talk to when one of these probation violations may be coming, I do think that they may either be able to challenge those violations or to better advise the youth. And I have to tell you, in the parent-child representation program that I was here talking about a couple weeks ago that I manage, lawyers are appointed for all probation violations. And what they tell me is, in those cases, they have such a good relationship with the juvenile department and the supervising entities that they are often able to head off these PVs in court because they get the phone call in advance. Hey, this kid's not complying with treatment. Hey, I can't get a hold of your client. What's going on? And so they are able to head it off not only through court, the court process, but also through informal advocacy. So, yes, I think there may be some opportunity.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, and I really appreciate Representative Olson's concerns about the fiscal part of this. I, too, have those same concerns. But I'm wondering if it's not worth looking at this more carefully, because if we actually had fewer kids at McLaren a little bit less time, it could more than offset the costs of the mm-hmm. of the council costs. So I'm just suggesting that it might be worth looking at that a little bit. Thank you.
Representative Barker, I'm sorry. I wanted to just follow up on that. Chair Barker, Representative Vial, I absolutely agree with what Ms. Miller said. I guess the piece that I want to kind of add on to that is, why do kids need good lawyers? And so I'm going to throw this out there. If any of the representatives are interested in watching a 10-minute TED Talk on why America's children need good lawyers, I have a link that I can send you. It's super fast. I believe I'm saying her name correctly, Kim Dvorchik. She's the former executive director of the National Juvenile Defender Center. She spoke about this, and in 10 minutes, she gives this this incredible synopsis of why juveniles need good lawyers and why juveniles need lawyers in general. And it would absolutely touch on the question that you had. How is this going to ultimately affect kids going to either OYA or kids being in the system?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I happen to have seen that TED Talk, and I absolutely was impressed by that. I think we all need to consider what she had to say there.
I'd be happy, Chair Barker, I'd be happy to send that to everyone.
Hey, Representative Orsi.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the 103. So we say 103 kids in 2015 had waived their right to counsel. So is that 103 kids that waived it, or 103 kids that were convicted because they waived their right to counsel? I just want to be clear on that.
Sorry. Chair Barker, members of the committee, we didn't look at whether or not the youth were convicted. We just looked at the front end.
So we just did the one. Follow up, please.
Please.
How many youth did we serve in 2015 in terms of kids that were brought in and charged?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, looking at our case credit data, what we've paid for, there were 3,500 petitions filed in 2015.
Okay, so 3,500.
And I think that's probably my rounding estimate. It's probably close.
So 3,500, and then 103 that availed themselves of this particular choice to not have counsel. Now, if you think about 103 versus 3,500, 103 is not very many. Secondly, I did the math, and I did the highest level, 900 times 103. That's $92,700. Personally, I don't see that as a huge fiscal myself.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenland.
Yes, thank you. Maybe you can help me understand this. I really support this bill. It seems important to me. But when an adult waives a right to a lawyer, mm-hmm. he or she is either deciding to represent themselves or pleading guilty. When a child waives it, it's essentially the same as pleading guilty, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. certainly the child's not going to defend himself. They'll say, okay, I'm guilty. That seems like a really bad thing to happen.
Exactly.
Right.
Am I reading the situation correct?
Oh, go ahead.
Please. Absolutely right.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, did you have another point? Because I would like to take advantage of this opening to make a point that I think is very important. These statistics that you got are lovely from my standpoint because it's, I don't know what the number was in year X, but it was probably 10 times that, okay, 5 or 6, 7 years ago. What's changed is attitudes on the part of specific supervisory juvenile court personnel or the judges who are sitting in juvenile court at this point. There is no guarantee that these numbers will remain that low. A new judge comes in, a different person in a supervisory role. It's good, it's positive, but there isn't any legal requirement or any legal principles to back up the point that we're trying to make here. And maybe it's not necessary, I think it is, because it's all a matter of the persuasion and arm twisting that was done to say this isn't good practice, you shouldn't do this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, this is probably directed to you, maybe not. Practically speaking, what do you envision this process looking like?
That's awesome.
So you can set the kid mm-hmm. down and say, do you want an attorney or not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we've accomplished anything. Certainly we've right. not accomplished right. the intent of this bill.
Right.
So what, keep in mind, 11 and younger uh-huh. are in a different bucket.
Right.
What is the conversation? What is the process that you envision with a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old?
Thank you so much for that question, Chair Barker, Representative Springer. Ms. Miller, myself, and Ms. Meyer had sat down a number of times, and I know that they had done a lot of work prior to me coming in on this. But when we were talking about what we wanted this to look like on the ground, what we were hoping to accomplish was a meaningful consultation. And so we're not talking about a lawyer being present in the courtroom for a whole string of juvenile kids waiting for their court appearance. What we're actually talking about is at that first appearance, it's determined whether that kid is financially eligible. That youth is then appointed counsel, and if they're out of custody, they go to that lawyer's office and they sit down with that lawyer and they talk about their case. They talk about what their options are. They also during that time talk about what does it mean to have a lawyer and what does it mean to represent yourself. And by the way, you can represent yourself if you want. And they have a truly meaningful, significant conversation about everything, and it's in a calm environment. So that can happen at the office, but that can also happen at detention. In my own practice, a lot of times my juveniles were in custody, and so I would, in a smaller county, walk across the street to the juvenile department, or in Washington County, drive downtown and go sit in with that client and talk to them, but have the same conversation. And so ultimately, not only are they getting the consult to talk about representing themselves, but they're getting to talk about their case. And I think that's really what we're wanting to address. We want kids to have lawyers. That's what we want. And so that I believe that that's what that process would look like.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
If I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to think about my comments carefully.
Of course.
So I frankly am not that hung up on the fiscal impact of this, which is a pretty uncommon thing for me to say, because I want kids, if they're waiving, to know why they're waiving. Mm-hmm. If they want to waive, that's fine. And we had a conversation earlier. I don't think we should require, I don't think it's any more righteous to require a kid to have an attorney if they don't want an attorney. So I'm okay with, and I know 11 and younger, it's different. What I don't want to see, and I want to put this out here on the record, what I don't want to see is the process that would be required to get so expanded that now we really are creating a ton of work when we don't need to create that ton of work. I completely agree. You got to remove the kid from the crisis or the excitement or the rush of an incident, because none of us function well in that, and kids sure don't. And so I understand those pieces. I just don't want to see this drawn out. As a former cop, the rule would be this, and by the time the rule got instituted, it was this. And this became the problem, not the rule. And that's what I don't want this to be a casualty of. Does that make sense?
I believe it does. I appreciate the comment, Representative Barker, or Chair Barker, rather, Representative Springer. Maybe Ms. Miller can also address this. The thought that I have is, it's a big deal to us, but ultimately we're talking about a small number. And so this, in comparison to the process that's already happening in juvenile courts across the state, I think that keeping that framework is important when we're considering it. But your comments are well taken.
Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Call up Krista Obold L. Eshelman. And after this testimony, I'm going to proceed to the next bill. If we have time, we'll make the phone call later. It's late in the day, so.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Krista Obold Eshelman, and I'm the lead appellate and research attorney at Youth Rights and Justice. I have been practicing juvenile law for 12 years, both at the trial level and at the appellate level. And I think, as you're all aware, that the juvenile delinquency system is complicated. It's, as Judge Welch was saying, it's not just a parental sort of guidance thing. There are many collateral consequences, many of which the youths don't initially have any clue about, or their parents, for that matter, don't have any clue about, such as the possibility that that they could be excluded from school or removed from their housing, or that sort of thing. And so the collective experience of the 17 attorneys at Youth Rights and Justice leads us to believe that that youths should not be waiving their right to counsel before they even essentially know what they're waiving, which is what happens if they don't talk to an attorney before waiving that. So we are in support of House Bill 2616 and the Dash One amendments. Youths often have a very limited or wrong understanding of what a defense attorney is at the beginning. We find that they may equate us with the prosecution. They think we're all the same. They may, because they first met with the juvenile court counselor, which is essentially the probation officer, sometimes they think that person is an attorney, or they're very surprised to find out that what they just told the juvenile court counselor was not confidential and is going to be used in whatever way that the juvenile court counselor wants to. We often also find that parents may feel pressure to hold their child accountable and to encourage them to waive when they don't, as I said, they don't even understand the consequences. We do see a significant percentage of youth, when a judge initially asks whether the youth wants an attorney, the youth says no. And in Multnomah County, the judges are generally very good about working hard to try to change the youth's mind and encourage them to accept that counsel. But youths have a lot of difficulty with the abstract concepts that are inherent in the juvenile court situation. And when we meet in a less pressured situation in our office, we are able to work individually with them to understand those concepts that are so difficult to understand. And we use a lot of time, number one, and repetition and diagrams and, you know, restating things and checking for comprehension until it may finally seem to be sinking in, this huge process that they are dealing with and what all of the myriad of consequences may be. As well as just the usual lack of brain development, we often have children that are traumatized by their childhood experiences, that are abusing substances, or have serious intellectual deficits that make the challenge all the more heavy to ensure that they really do have an idea of what they're doing here. Sometimes after forming a relationship with a client, we realize they're so low functioning that we need to ask the court to find them unfit to proceed in the case because they're not competent. And that's the sort of thing that cannot be seen or determined from a very, very brief interchange between the judge and a child who may have learned to accommodate their deficits by being very agreeable. And yes, agreeing with whatever the judge is asking. Yes, do you understand? Yes. And do you agree? Yes. And then they walk out of court and they ask us, what just happened? Tell me, explain that to me. And they may have had no clue what they were just agreeing to. So that's the sort of thing that requires a more in-depth conversation than is possible for a judge to do in court. And it's also not required under current Oregon case law for the judges to advise youths of collateral consequences. So even sex offender registration, that's not required that the judge advise the youth of that before accepting an uncounseled plea under current case law. So I actually currently have an appeal where there was a youth who came back years later saying, I waived my counsel. I didn't know that I was going to have to register as a sex offender. And so that's something that can happen. And I do want to address Representative Olson's point about whether these youths are waiving their Miranda rights. And I want to just clarify that this bill doesn't have to do with that stage where they are waiving Miranda rights, and there is another bill that's actually addressing that, but that's not this bill. But even if they're waiving their Miranda rights when they're being questioned by police or something, once they have an attorney, the attorney can look at that and say, was that really a knowing and intelligent waiver? And maybe that was not. And that's something that no one would ever have any idea about if there isn't an attorney involved. Bottom line is we believe HB 2616 is an important step in ensuring that the most vulnerable in our population are provided with due process, and encourage you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. And there's been a lot of robust conversation. I want to weigh in from my perspective as a parent and also someone who is starting to work in the legal arena of helping people who have collateral consequences of past decisions move forward. I think, you know, I have a 15-year-old and an 18-year-old, and and they're high-functioning kids, and I would say, you know, it's impossible for me to imagine them being able to knowingly waive the right to counsel without really close information about what the consequences of that are. And then, you know, and I'm an attorney, and my husband is an attorney too, and I now work for the Metropolitan Public Defender on expungements and helping people move forward after convictions. And even though I've been an attorney since 1995, I'm learning a huge amount in this new role about the collateral consequences of plea agreements and adjudications that I would never have known. So I really support this bill in the strongest way, even though I know it has some fiscal attachments. It just seems like people are really empty-handed unless they have guidance on these decisions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to agree with my colleague, both in terms of the people that I dealt with. Working in law enforcement in a residential district, we dealt a lot with kids. And then having had my own 18-year-old and 21-year-old, I've seen that it's true. In many ways, they are very high-functioning, but they also are not fully ready for the adult world. And so I, too, support this bill for those reasons, not to try and let kids get away with something, but to make sure that their rights are being protected just as much as adult rights. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2616. and open a hearing, a public hearing on House Bill 2615. The phone call will not be made. The person is no longer available on the case we do.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. We have House Bill 2615. House Bill 2615 makes the penalty of theft when it is committed by returning stolen merchandise dependent on the value of the property. It would reduce the penalty for this type of offense when the value of the merchandise is under $1,000. There are no amendments.
Thank you. Yale Meyer, Mike Rees, and Brian Francisconi.
Please. Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Shifting gears here from the juvenile world to the adult world. This bill is presented to you in the context of the larger debate occurring nationally, but also in Oregon. What is the efficacy of incarcerating people for low, no violence, but minimal dollar value property crimes? Does it happen in Oregon? And if so, what does it look like when it does? So the reason OCDLA introduced this bill is it wanted to invite the conversation amongst this committee and the legislative body at large as to whether or not it sanctions the use of one of the theft statutes, the theft by receiving statute, in a way that does felonize the nonviolent taking of property of minimal value. So we'll be talking about something that on our side we call ROCA thefts, but on the industry side they call return fraud. And I'd like to cue it up with this example. Suppose that there are two identical twins and they're standing in the aisleway of a store. Twin number one takes an item off the shelf, walks to the exit, bolts out the exit, and gets apprehended in the parking lot. That would be a more generic shoplift. That would be theft by taking. That would be the serious level of that would be determined by the dollar value of the merchandise. So if it's less than $100, it would be a C misdemeanor. Twin number two takes off the shelf the very same item. Instead of leaving the store, goes up to the customer service counter and attempts to return the item, saying usually, here is the receipt that I had, or my brother-in-law bought it for me, I can't find the receipt, but can I please have cash value for this item? And in that instance, the district attorneys are prosecuting these under a different theory of theft. It's the theft by receiving statute, which is always a felony. So in the one instance when twin number one walks out, it would be determined by the dollar value of the merchandise. In the second instance, twin number two, instead trying to return the item, it would be it's always a C felony regardless of value. The theft by receiving statute was enacted back in the 1971 Criminal Code. It was adopted from the Model Penal Code. And really what the reason theft by receiving is always a felony is that it's designed to catch the fence. This is the person who is in the business of receiving and buying stolen property and turning around and selling stolen property. This is the person who has a commercial enterprise, and because they've commercialized shoplifting and they've incentivized yet and still more shoplifting, the Model Penal Code said they're more culpable than the shoplifter. And so we're going to hold them responsible as a felon regardless of dollar value. So now the truth of it is in Oregon that you could actually get the fence of these shoplifting on a B felony through an aggravated theft. And if it's through interstate commerce, you can get it federally as well. But the Model Penal Code saw a big difference between the shoplifter and the fence, who is actually in the business of buying stolen property and turning around selling it. What happened, the reason this is called ROCA thefts is there was a case, State versus ROCA, and I don't know who the deputy district attorney was who came up with this theory, but quite frankly, as a lawyer, my hat goes off to that person because they were awake and they were doing what lawyers do. They were pushing the envelope based on language that was present and available to them. The theory goes that by taking the item off of the shelf and holding on to it, they have now appropriated that item to themselves without the intent of paying for it. And so in that instance, they have stolen the item. They're still in the store. By walking up to the counter, they are now selling the stolen property that they just stole when they took it off the aisle. So some really bright district attorney somewhere decided that he could up the ante on this return theft situation by charging a theft by receiving. And the Court of Appeals said, you know, under opinions, you probably could. You can do it. And then thereafter, all of these cases were charged as C felonies under the theft by receiving statute. So we think it's time to ask this legislative body, is that how you intend that theft by receiving statute to be employed? Because it never has really come back to the legislature to ask, is this what you intended? I have here two practitioners from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. This gets very consequential in the context of Ballot Measure 57. Yes, indeed, people are going to prison for theft of items of very low value. And they will explain what that profile looks like. I am aware that there is going to be oppositional testimony. It's coming in through the district attorneys and also through the loss prevention folks with some of the stores. I would ask this committee, again, I don't know exactly what they'll say, but I would ask this committee to listen closely. I think the bottom line is this is a big hassle for the stores. There's more of a dollar loss by paying out cash than there ever is by loss of the merchandise. And there's an administrative load, and it's an irritation. I will say that regardless of how these thefts occur, theft number one out in the parking lot or theft number two at the customer service, the same result occurs. They do arrest the individual, and they are trespassed out of the store. So they're told you can't come back in, and if you do, that alone will also be a crime. That will be a trespass. So it, bottom line, it does look the same from that side. Lastly, too, I think there'll be discussion of a larger enterprise behind all this, where there really are fences at work receiving some of these items. But again, I expect that the practitioner here will tell you that this often can look, this can be too, also very individualized thefts at a much lower level than that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a technical
question? Yes, you can.
Perhaps to the council. I was trying to figure out how it does it. It does it in two places in the bill by adding the exemption in line 11 and 12. Is that right?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlake, thank you for asking that question. The bill simply clarifies in the theft by receiving statute that it's not applicable to the return of merchandise. On its face, it makes it look like the conduct's being legalized, and it's not. There are a bevy of other theft statutes that a district attorney would employ, most particularly probably theft by taking or theft by deception. So all it does is remove.
This is in the theft by return.
Theft by receiving.
And by receiving piece, and it basically exempts that selling back to the store from which it was. So there's also the $1,000 thing in here as well.
May I take a look at that perhaps and then respond?
Please in the
definition.
Chair Barker.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson, I'll step in while we're looking at that.
Give your name.
Brian Francesconi, supervisor at the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. One thing I'd like to add here is this crime tends to be, from our perspective, an obvious crime. and a crime that's not sophisticated. It's the opposite of what we understand as a concern. When you walk into a store and pick up a pair of headphones and then walk up to the counter with those headphones and try and return them, there's nothing sophisticated about that. It's usually an obvious crime. The person's being watched on video, and you watch them pick it up, walk to the counter, and then either pull out on the way to the counter an old receipt they had that has the wrong date on it, again, obvious, or not have a receipt and have a bad story. And so in our experience, and I can only speak for our experience at the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, these are individuals who are desperate, have little means left, and think they're committing what we call a community court crime. If you walk out of that store in our county with those $20 headphones, I've had this case, you get community court and a dismissal, depending on your criminal history. If you walk up and try and sell it instead, you're looking at a, in the old days, 13-month suspended sentence. Under the new system, you're looking at, depending on your criminal history, 30 months in prison. I was a young attorney when I first had this case happen to me. I'd been practicing in our felony unit where all we do is felony property and drug cases. And I had just this person pick up a pair of headphones and some batteries worth $20.98, walk them to the counter. He got arrested for theft three. The DA indicted it for theft one under this theory, offered me 13 months. I was outraged. How can you go to prison for 13 months as a young one-year attorney for $20.98 worth of stealing? We went to trial. I litigated it like a two-and-a-half-year attorney can only litigate, doing everything I could and losing everything I could. Back then, they didn't have mandatory minimums. They weren't escape eligible. They were escape eligible under repo. The judge on the case, I believe it was Judge Roberts, gave him a downward departure to probation. I looked up his case last night. He got revoked a year and a half later. He served 13 months. Today, he would take a suspended sentence. He would take 30 months up front, and then he would have gotten revoked, and the citizens of Oregon would have been paying for 30 months on that $20. We pled somebody out last week, not 6 months ago, not 12 months ago, last week to 28 months prison for under $20. We see these cases a lot. We've seen three in the last 2 weeks. We see this so much, we don't even get outraged anymore. Thank you.
I'd like to ask, what was the person's record?
Oh, for sure, right? So, sorry.
That makes it, no, that's fine.
For sure, Chair Barker. You got to do this right, Chair Barker. Absolutely, right? If you have, you need to have the predicate history to be under ballot measure 57. Now, that can be two cases that have gone through community court. That can be one case you're still on, and that's a presumptive 18 months. Let's say this person has a robbery one from when they were 25, and now they're 60 and in a much sadder place, and they do this. That's that 30-month case. So absolutely, their criminal histories are worse, but under 57, they're not like A's. They're not necessarily high. They can still have semi-minimal criminal history.
Yeah, it seems to me that most of these lower theft cases don't get that unless they have a pretty horrific background and they, you know, finally it's the courts are going, okay, enough's enough.
Add to that, Rep. Barker? That's true. Let's say I don't have a criminal history and I commit this. We had a person a year ago, a grandmother, I'm sorry, maybe it was 2 years ago, a grandmother, never been arrested before. It's in my materials that got uploaded. She took care of her granddaughter. The mom worked. The child needed cough medicine, had a cold. She couldn't afford the cough medicine. She didn't want to steal the cough medicine. So she did one of these return thefts because the cough medicine cost $9. She had $6. She didn't want to steal the full $9, so she sold $3. She took a felony conviction. Having never been arrested before, she still had to take a felony conviction. And sometimes we will get offers on misdemeanors on these, but often we get offers of felonies. Often, if it's a presumptive prison case, we get offers of suspended sentences.
Okay, thank you. Gail, did you want to, were you going to respond to Representative?
Thank you, Chair Barker. These two are the experts on Measure 57, but it's important to know that it can be, just as Mr. Francisconi said, two prior community court adjudications. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't repeat conduct going on here, but the aggregated amount of these cases can be very, very minimal value. Yeah.
And were you going to answer? You were looking up something for Representative Greenlick?
Yeah, and I just lost it again. Oh. Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I think you're talking about the summary part of the bill. If you look at the black text, with respect to that $1,000 thing, with respect to the text of the bill, all the bill does is it says you cannot use the theft by receiving statute.
On line 15 and 16 or somewhere. I think I...
15,
yeah, on line...
11 and 12? 11
and 12. Line 12 and 13. That's all it does, is that right?
Yes.
11 and 12.
11 and 12.
Right here.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. You're welcome.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. This is Michael Rees. I'm an attorney at Metropolitan Public Defender. I've been practicing for 16 years. In preparation for this testimony, I took a look at my cases. I wanted to see if my impression was right, that these cases in which somebody is charged with a felony and has unexpectedly harsh results because of this law was not an outlier. I wanted to see if this was really happening repeatedly, and I found 29 cases, in my own caseload that were these kinds of thefts, and I did a quick and dirty tally of them and discovered that the median amount taken in these cases was $43. So that people were charged with felonies for these minimal amounts over and over again. And the examples I found were, for example, $6. A person who was drug addicted, as were two-thirds of these people that I found on my list. She was drug addicted and she stole $6 through this scam. And she agreed to a plea bargain for probation and a felony conviction. Unfortunately, she failed probation and ended up getting 18 months in prison for the $6 theft. I found another man on this list who stole $7. He got a misdemeanor conviction because we dealed that into a misdemeanor because his criminal history was minimal. But this is part of the problem that I see with these situations. When somebody is facing these harsh and unexpected results for minimal behavior, it puts the district attorney in the driver's seat rather than the judge or the jury. And the district attorney is the person who can say, all right, I'm going to give this person a little break. I'm going to give this person a misdemeanor conviction when I could get a felony at trial. I'm going to agree that this person can have probation when after the trial I can demand that this person gets prison. And as we've said a couple times, it's remarkably easy under Measure 57 to be facing prison for a Theft 1 conviction. I would point out that if you go on a joyride, borrow somebody's car without permission, you don't have to take it away forever, but you get an unauthorized use of a vehicle conviction, and you're on probation for that, as young people might do when they're on probation for one bit of naughtiness like that, go off and do something else, like a return fraud. If you're on probation for unauthorized use of a vehicle, and you get convicted for theft in the first degree, not only are you facing 18 months in prison, you're facing mandatory 18 months in prison. A judge presiding over your sentencing doesn't have the option of doing anything but sending you to prison unless the district attorney agrees to the leniency. So we end up in these cases, as I said, I found 29 of them, asking for mercy from the prosecutor, which is the situation, and I want you to know that is what the situation is for these kinds of thefts. And the other thing that I want to point out is that we know what it looks like when somebody's involved in a big organized retail theft operation. I've seen those cases, and they have nothing to do with these return fraud cases. You don't need a big operation to do the return fraud. For less than $50, it's real common. The stores won't require a receipt. You just go do it. It takes 5 minutes. It doesn't require more than one person. It doesn't require a very intelligent person. It could be done by someone who's intoxicated, and that is often the case. The big operations are people that have a whole lot of goods. Somebody stealing 10 bottles of shampoo, somebody stealing a whole case of diapers and taking it and selling it in some shady little store and doing it repeatedly until they rack up a large number of these that can be aggregated to something more than $1,000 or $10,000. So it's a different category, and I don't think if we revise the return fraud statute to no longer make these simple transactions a felony, we're going to lose the opportunity to prosecute people that are really doing a lot of damage through organized retail theft.
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Of the 29 cases, how many of those this was their first offense?
Chair Barker, I did not tally that. I did note that several of these people got immediate misdemeanor treatment. So that indicates to me that those people likely had minimal criminal history. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of those 29 people, no, 9 of them got immediate misdemeanor treatment. And that means that they had minimal criminal history. But they still got a criminal conviction for theft, which has a lot of consequences.
Which they committed a crime. So you get one. I've actually been a victim of a crime, of a burglary in my home. And I got to say, I never once in the years since that happened referred to that as borrowing without permission. It was a crime. It wasn't borrowing something of mine without permission. I just want to be clear when we're talking about this that we're not talking about people doing just little things. We're talking about people also committing crimes. And if you take my stuff without asking, it's not borrowing without permission. It's a crime.
Of course.
Well, I'd like to ask, too, so of the 29, because you're in the felony unit, how many people, if you, maybe you wouldn't have any idea, but how many people were not charged as a felony to begin with? They were arrested for that. Do you have any idea that?
No, I don't.
Okay, I mean,
I don't find that out.
I didn't want to ask unfair questions.
So,
thank you.
So, Chair Barker, and also Representative Stringer, a couple things worth noting. Both of these witnesses are from Multnomah County, and so this does this is the standard charging practice in the other 36 counties as well. We've asked for stories. There were anecdotal stories. 19-year-old kid, first arrest. Arrested felony, was required to plead to a felony. So now that might not mean that it wouldn't be reduced to a misdemeanor at the backside of a probationary period or something, but the point of it is no prior criminal history, charged with a felony, required to plead to a felony. So their experience is what it is, but it's a Multnomah County perspective, and it can look different in the other 36. And just to underscore what the bill does by removing this from the theft by receiving statute, I'd asked LC, can't you make sure that it's okay to charge under the other statutes? And they were like, no, we don't do it that way. But there are other statutes for the district attorney to use. Those other statutes, though, are tethered to the dollar value of the merchandise, and that's what's making the big difference here. So admittedly, your point, Representative Spring, is well taken. These are crimes, and we're not suggesting they shouldn't be prosecuted as such.
Okay, thank you, Representative Post.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. The gentleman on the end, I just been thinking about what you said about the $20.
Yeah.
And it comes back to me, that was when they got caught. I went 75 down the freeway the other day, sorry, but I didn't get caught. How many times have I done that and I didn't get caught? Now, I know you can't quantify and give me that number, but mm-hmm. I doubt very few people do it once.
Representative Barker, Representative Post. First of all, in my experience, as I said at the beginning, people will commit crimes multiple times until they get caught. I agree with that. This is not a sophisticated crime. This is a crime of that people, in my experience, and I can only speak for my county and my clients and the people I supervise, but when you're walking into a store, usually you're not dressed that nicely. Often the LPO is watching you as soon as you walk in the store, maybe not with everybody, and you go and pick something up off the shelf, take something out of your pocket and walk up, you're not committing a sophisticated crime. And it's not something that normal people do, as opposed to all of us who speed. And so I think the danger of having this individual, you could say that about most crimes, I guess. You know, lots of people steal multiple times. This is the only category where we treat it like that burglary that Representative Springer talked about. That individual goes to prison who broke into your house. We are right now treating the person who picks up the headphones from a criminal perspective the same way. And as a criminal defense practitioner, it's confusing to us. It's hard for us to explain to people who think they're stealing diapers for $20, who we have cases of $4, explaining to a person charged with a $4 crime, no, you don't get community court. Yes, you're charged with a felony. Yes, the state is insisting on a suspended prison sentence of 30 months. That is a hard conversation for us to tell them.
Okay, thank you. Any further? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
He's having to get out of the way of Jenny Burdick. Is the problem. Betsy Earl, Sean Miller, and Sean Cosgrove. Please go ahead in any order, but remember to identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I am here representing the Northwest Grocery Association in opposition to House Bill 2615. And, you know, you heard the debate for the bill and you heard some examples, and I want to give some further examples because I think we believe this is a far more sophisticated crime than just picking up an item and walking out of the store. And so, yes, you did hear one of the schemes involved in this particular crime, but we do believe that if this bill passes, it's going to only increase the problem. And this is about a $15 billion problem nationally with our retailers. It's a serious problem. It's getting worse every year. And again, if you pass this particular bill, we believe it's going to get even worse. And so I want to go through just some quick examples of some of this, what we call refund fraud. And again, you heard one of the examples. It's a quick cash refund example where the person goes into the store and goes straight to the refund counter to receive the cash value of that. There is a lot of other iterations, and I think you'll hear from Sean next, with Fred Meyer Loss Prevention on just what we actually see in our stores. But some of the others are they steal the item, they walk out of the store, they have the item in their possession, they may go back into the store or go to another store and try to receive a refund for that. The other one is they actually purchase the item. So they'll purchase an item, leave the store, they have a receipt for that item, and the item's already left the store, and they'll go in back into the store with the receipt, go get the item they just purchased, and then go to the refund counter, receive the full refund for that item that they just walked out of the store, and then they'll use the item that has left the store maybe to go to a different store to try to receive another refund without the receipt. So you can see how this is just not the value or the cost of the product. It can turn into losing the cost of the product plus the value, again, the cash value of that product, in, you know, 2 to 3 times. And I think what we're seeing is it's more than one person involved in this. And so, you know, there is also, you know, internal refund fraud where someone is colluding with a store employee, falsifying refunds, and that's a serious issue. And then there's also kind of a more even higher level of professionalism where they're buying equipment with barcodes and you know, receipt equipment where they're actually you know, at a more professional level trying to defraud the store of the cash value. And so, you know, there's lots of different iterations of this particular scam. It's a serious problem, and so we oppose the bill. Again, with me is Sean Crozier with Fred Meyer Loss Prevention, here to answer any questions and talk about what we're seeing in particularly our stores. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Sean Crozier. I'm a district loss prevention manager here representing Fred Meyer. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposing this bill. You know, Fred Meyer does have some concerns in regards to this bill. I think you've heard today that the comparison between shoplifting and refund fraud, as we consider it. But I think, again, you've heard kind of a minor level of it. You know, we just don't deal with individuals that are coming into our location and picking an item up and taking it to the counter being a first-time offense. A lot of times with the loss prevention, we typically have anywhere from 300 to 400 associates in our store, and if you've ever been in our stores on a Friday or Saturday, you know how many customers we have in there as well. Most locations are limited with 1 or 2 loss prevention associates. It's fairly hard to observe everybody that's coming in and out of those stores and what they're doing. Again, we don't see the comparison between shoplifting and refund fraud as the same. We see refund fraud as being a more serious crime. It does take planning. Most of the cases that we do see involve multiple individuals that show up at a store. They will come in and purchase several high dollar items. Again, they'll take those items back out to their vehicles. They then turn around and either hand off the receipts or come back in with the receipts solely to select the same item. Either they will walk out with those items as well, or they'll take that item then to the return counter and get cash back. Again, the cash back they're receiving is at full retail value, opposed to a shoplifting where it's the cost of the merchandise. It's not as significant as a loss to the retailer. When we start to see these groups working together, very often when we make these apprehensions, we've turned out that they've been involved with multiple people before and they've done this multiple times before. This isn't a first-time offense. Typically, your first-time offense is the individual coming in, as previously mentioned, selecting an item and running out of the store with it. They are worried about getting caught, and typically there's not a lot of planning ahead of time. With refund fraud, we're starting to see more and more planning, more and more working with either friends or associates, and it does tie back a lot to drug community. A lot of times the refunds, when we get them in the office and they tell us that their money is being used because they are addicted to drugs. We've also seen that the merchandise being picked up in our stores, time and time again they come in, they use these receipts from legitimate purchases, where they've culled out of trash cans, they've gotten off of the sidewalks or out of shopping carts in our lobbies, and they come in and select high value items out of the store, and they'll do it repeatedly over and over again. These items are typically taken to a fence. They're sold online. They're sold on. There's a number of apps that are out there now that they use to in turn make profit off of the retailers. We do see that refund fraud is growing in our communities. We're starting to look at it as a more serious crime than shoplifting. We don't spend a lot of time focusing on the petty shoplift cases. Our time, when we're in our stores, we're focused more on these high-value cases.
Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing the Oregon Retail Council in this instance. The Oregon Retail Council is an affiliate or a portion of Associated Oregon Industries. We represent the largest group of retailers in the state. And the Retail Council has significant concerns about House Bill 2615. I just, you've heard a few things about the other side of how retail refund fraud works. And I just wanted to point out that the example that was given at the beginning of the last panel about the twins that come into the store, both steal the identical item, one runs out the door and the other one runs up to the front of the store to return it, is intuitively appealing. But from our standpoint, that is not generally the way the crime works. We more frequently see, as was mentioned earlier, groups of people that are working together to do refund fraud, and very frequently those groups have equipment that puts that creates new receipts or puts new tags on merchandise that's been stolen from the store earlier or purchased from the store earlier in order to perpetrate the fraud. The other thing that you heard was, you know, I think an attempt to minimize the effect of the crime or how important the crime was. Somebody said that the median level of cost for items that were stolen under refund return fraud was $43 or something like that, as if that was a minimal amount and therefore perhaps not genuinely theft. I think the point I would make to you is that there's a specific reason that there's an average of $43, and that is that most of our stores have a $50 limit on no receipt returns. If you go to a store and try and return something without a receipt and it's $100, you'll get much more difficult of a time than if you go in there and try and return something that's $25. $25 is generally not a problem without a receipt. Something over $50 is almost always going to be a problem. You'll have to give your ID, and you might be able to do that once or twice, you know. But stores will keep much better in track of what's going on with a $50 or over return than they will of something under that. So I think it's unfair to retailers to minimize this crime just because it appears to be, you know, on an instance-by-instance basis, a small dollar item. That's exactly how this crime works. People taking small items over and over and over again in order to add up to a larger amount, which they support their drug habit or support themselves. And the way you make it work is to do it on an under $50 basis. So I think it is probably not fair to classify this crime or to change the classification of this crime based on the dollar amounts that are involved in it.
Mr. Chair, if I can only add just one comment, because I did hear several of the examples, and I did talk to Gail just about, you know, the egregious jail time on some of these cases, and it feels to me that, you know, this particular bill is a little unfair to us because it appears in those cases, those are Measure 11, 57, you know.
57, they're not 11.
Issues where, you know, a repeat offenses in those cases, and this may have been the one that sent them to jail. And so, you know, again, I think the bill creates it'll just create more problems for us when in increased thefts.
And what I thought I heard too was that it's the probation violation after this theft that's sending them to prison. I mean, they have this hanging over them, and then that's kind of like walk the straight and narrow.
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair.
And so I'd also like to ask, I don't know if you're able to check people's records. Does everybody get arrested, or do you kind of monitor that inside and make some decisions in-house?
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. The Los Berichon associates that are in the stores don't have access to check the records. They do make the decisions based off of not only the action, their demeanor, you know, did they appear to be professional, and also the interview, if we get the chance to interview them. a lot of times when we do make those apprehensions, we end up having people run from us, and we're relying on the police department to be able to apprehend them, so we don't always get those chances to talk. But the individuals in the stores make those determinations whether they want to involve the police or not.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative Post.
Two quick questions, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman. They're connected.
Please, go ahead.
Betsy, you answered a little bit of this, so maybe so. But Sean in the middle, Sean.
The other Sean.
Fred Meyer. I think has wonderful customer service, and I don't mean to. I'm not trying to kiss up here, but you have wonderful customer service. How, if this were lowered to a misdemeanor, how do you think it would affect customer service? I don't want you to speak for every other store, but for Fred Meyer.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Post, I do believe that if it was lowered to a misdemeanor, it would have a great effect on our customer service. Already, as is, we have associates that are trying to engage in customer service of our honest customers that are in the store, let alone spending hours of their time when they can't get a hold of loss prevention, following and trying to offer customer service to potential shoplifters, people that are doing these refund fraud crimes. In most cases, you're looking at an hour to 2 hours that they could be following people around just trying to get them to put merchandise back and leave the store. That takes away from our honest customers. That takes away from us being able to walk up and help somebody find what they really want.
Second. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this affect, other than perhaps what Betsy said, which is current, I think you said currently if it's under 50, kind of?
That's sort of a general guideline.
How would this affect return policies? Again, let's just talk about Fred Meyer, perhaps instead of other stores, just because you're here.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Post. The current policies that we've had in place in the 20 years that I've been with Fred Meyer have been changed multiple times. Just to try to help reduce this kind of behavior. Again, from a customer service standpoint, we want to help everybody that has a legitimate return. We don't want anybody to not be satisfied with what they've purchased. Unfortunately, we've had to put so many different policies in place, limiting the dollar amount, limiting the quantity of returns you can do, whether you have to have a receipt or not. I think it would, again, greatly hinder our ability to serve our honest customers that are coming up to the customer service desk. Did that answer your question?
Well, I guess, have you actually thought through if this were to pass, would it affect your return policy tomorrow?
I feel it absolutely would.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Really quick. First off, I worked in loss prevention in another life and was once punched in the face for that. Very lovely. However,
I know, it was very sad.
However, so it's very obvious to me that this is a very important issue for all of you, and it's an important issue for the folks who brought forward this bill. The one thing that I wonder, Mr. Chair, is are we going to have any other testimony on this bill?
No.
Okay, so the one thing that I think...
Nobody signed up. I do. Yeah, we can have a DA come up.
The one thing that I think is missing here is not so much that these things are a serious problem. I think the underlying question is, does the prison sentences, the long prison sentences, does that really help with recidivism? And so I'm not sure that we're getting to that discussion. And I think it's an indictment, in some ways, perhaps, of the mandatory minimum sort of approach. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay. No more questions. Did you want to come up? Yeah. Okay, thank you, panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I've got to take off.
Please.
Yeah, I do, too.
Go ahead and roll it. I'll hear you.
I have to go.
Something I said?
But go.
I want to say before you started.
Yes, me too. I have to go testify.
A lot of people have 3 o'clock
Understandable. As do I, but go ahead. I'll stay.
Well, thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee that that remain here. My name is Brian Cinsoni. I'm a deputy district attorney in Clackamas County, where I've been a DA for 7 years. I'm currently working in the juvenile department, but previous to that, I was in the property unit that dealt with crimes like this. And I think I'll just limit my comments, because I know that we're really pressed for time, about some of the legalities and answering some of the issues that I think were raised with respect to the punishments. The reality is, the individuals that we're dealing with in situations like this have extensive criminal histories. And this is not an outlying anecdotal case that I found from our office, where an individual has 52 convictions spanning 25 years, half of those for theft from 8 counties. He has a potential of a max repo sentence for this case, and he did take a 13-month prison sentence for this. But I just want the committee to remember a couple of things, that even where a defendant is facing prison, it's often because they have this substantial criminal history that's not a dated history, but is something more recent. And even where somebody is a repeat offender with nominal history, the state would almost always offer a dispositional departure in those cases to a probationary sentence where somebody could get services, particularly for drug offenses or drug problems that they may have. Routinely, I would accept these sorts of offenders into our adult drug court program to try to get them drug treatment services. Some counties, I think we all need to remember, don't offer drug court for misdemeanor offenders. So if we did reduce this to misdemeanors, they wouldn't be able to avail themselves of that very good service. And even if the state, and I think this is very important, even if the state doesn't offer a departure sentence where somebody is eligible to go to prison on these, there still is a statutory framework for a defendant to approach the court if they haven't had a departure previously to say, the degree of harm is such that's less severe than other offenses, that there's been a significant period of time that I haven't been a criminal, I'm amenable to treatment, and can ask the court for a dispositional departure, assuming they haven't had one previously. So I think that as we think of this, we also need to remember that there are statutory mechanisms to seek those departure sentences. And also, my colleagues will, prosecutorial discretion does go into these sorts of cases. When you have an individual with 52 convictions, it's certainly something different than an individual who has no criminal history and is stealing diapers or cough medicine for their sick child. Of course, we employ discretion in those circumstances. And the last point I would end with is that when somebody has no criminal history, even if you had a prosecutor that required them to plead to a felony and they did so, they could reduce that to a misdemeanor after they successfully complete their probation and would be able to expunge that offense if they're crime-free for another 3 years. So you already have many statutory mechanisms that recognize some of these issues and some of the maybe aberrant behavior where it's somebody without an extensive criminal history. But those that we're dealing with often have that extensive history. They're part of efforts that are more systematic to victimize the community and the stories that you just heard about. So I just wanted to put that in framework
for
you as well.
I'm sorry those weren't here to hear that.
I got it.
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Just to think, because you had to go so fast.
Yes, sorry.
I was, you were going right past me. Departure? What is that exactly, the context of that?
Well, if somebody is in a position from prior convictions, and there are predicate offenses that somebody has to have committed and been convicted of, and there's a list of those under the repeat property statutes, assuming that they have committed those predicate offenses, theft, identity theft, burglary, unlawful use of a vehicle, and they are eligible to go to prison for a new offense, the state can offer a departure sentence where, even though you may be looking at 18 months, 24 months, whatever the case may be, based on your criminal history, the state can still offer you probation with the prospect of being revoked if you don't abide by the terms of your probation. That is hanging out there as an incentive, hopefully, to assure that they're complying with their probation. So oftentimes you would have an individual who may be facing a prison term, and I would say to them, okay, well, look, you're based on your criminal history, you may have 18, 22, 24 months of prison for this new offense, but instead of doing that, we're going to put you in drug court. where you're going to get multiple opportunities to change your life around. And, you know, if you don't do that, well, then ultimately there may be a prison sentence out there. But some of the examples that were provided earlier of somebody who does this and is looking at 30 months in prison, to get to a point where somebody would be looking at 30 months in prison, they would have had to have committed the two predicate offenses to even become a repeat property offender, and then commit and been convicted of six additional property offenses for them to be facing 30 months. So you have to have a pretty extensive history in order to put yourself in a position to be facing 24, 26, 30 months of prison. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, I had to be so quick about it. It is complicated.
Thank you for hurrying up. I appreciate that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll close the hearing on House Bill 26. Very much.
Thank you.
And I'll close the hearing on House Bill 26. I appreciate that. Okay, thank you.